Okay, we're going to call the Senate Education Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, February 28th. The time is a little bit after 8, about 8:05. In attendance are Co-Chair Thomas, Senator Davis, Senator Stevens, Senator French, and myself, Senator Meyer. We do have a quorum. In fact, we have the full committee here this morning. I want to welcome everybody for being here this morning and braving the winds to get up to the Capitol here. Is there any business to come before the committee before we get started? Okay, seeing none. What we hope to do today is return to Senate Bill 8, finish up any last-minute comments that committee members may have on Senate Bill 8, as well as the administration has requested that they at least get their comments on record as well. They did not testify last meeting and would like to at least be able to comment some on it before we consider what we're going to do with Senate Bill 8. It is my intention, as well as Senator Thomas, to move Senate Bill 8 out today unless we hear something to the contrary from the administration. Then we would like to start on Senate Bill 6, which is the pre-K programs, and then the second half of the meeting, we would like to hear from our chancellors that are here with us this morning visiting us, and welcome all of you. Thank you for coming, by the way. I know a couple of you were on the flight with me last night. It was that was a little excitement here, more excitement than we wanted, I think. Let's see. It's my understanding that the outgoing Chancellor Fran Ulmer will not be here, but we do have incoming Chancellor Tom Case, Chancellor Brian Rogers, and Chancellor John Pugh. So we will plan, we'll stop at 8:30 and hopefully get to your comments and questions. So first, let's go back to Senate Bill 8, which is Senator Davis's bill relating to student questionnaires and surveys. As I mentioned, the public testimony was closed on this. We held it over so the people could have a chance to look at, committee members could have a chance to look at the survey itself and see if there's any questions there. There's also a colored graph comparison between the various reports 2007 and 2009. Is there any questions that committee members may have? And has everybody seen the surveys? I see Senator Thomas, you have yours there.
I do.
Okay. Any comments or questions? Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, the only negative comments I've received by email are folks that are concerned about having an opportunity to making sure that they get the material so they can take their child out of the program when they want to. And could we just be reminded how that happens and how a parent will have an opportunity, I think several opportunities, and is it just a written notice you give to the child and expect them to give to the parent, or are there other ways that parents will learn that this is their one opportunity to take their child out of this this program?
Okay, I think there's several options, and yeah, I'll let the sponsor.
Well, I'd like for Tom to come up and go through it. We went through it, but we'll be glad to go through it again so people can have a better understanding.
Through the chair, I'm Tom Obermeyer, aide to Senator Davis.
And point to where it is in the bill also while you're doing it.
The bill is rather brief. You'll notice the notice requirements are on page 1, section 2, and beginning on line 10, and they continue through page 2, the last page, on line 12. But procedurally, as it was explained by Michael Karofsky, the expert at Anchorage School District, they first of all ask for permission in fall when the students are enrolling, and the parents will sign a form that they will or will not, do not want their children to participate in questionnaires and surveys.
Tom, could you tell me how, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Could you tell me how the parent gets that information, that first step that you're talking about?
There's a form through the chair, Senator Stevens, that is signed and is available at a desk where they are signing up for classes. And it's usually a unique colored sheet. It's something separate so they know that it's something they should pay attention to. And that's the first and initial opportunity for them to recognize that there will be surveys perhaps offered during the school year. Now, this survey is only offered biennially, and it's only offered in the spring. So since it comes up about March, I think about this time of year, they will give out another notice in writing to the parents and send it home and indicate that this survey is going to be administered, and if they have any questions, they can go online and review it. They can talk to the school and so forth. In addition to that, this particular bill expands on the notice requirements, giving them a very detailed description of the survey, the date the survey is going to be administered, the sponsor, notice an opportunity to review it, description of the manner it's going to be administered, instructions for submitting written permission or denial, and who they would contact in the school district if they wished to. The main difference in this particular bill from the previous procedure simply on the section 3 is that on page 2 is that if they do have an objection as a parent, they would ask that they provide the teacher or school principal written denial for the student's participation. But explained in the same paragraph, it says that the student, him or herself, may refuse to answer specific questions or participate in the survey themselves. So if they find any of the questions objectionable or they object to the survey itself, they can decline doing so on their own initiative. Finally, indicating to remind people that this survey is totally anonymous. It is collected by the Centers for Disease Control. Each student puts their own survey in a sealed envelope. It goes into another envelope at the in the room and in a sealed envelope back to CDC. I don't know how they collect them, but the teacher will not have the opportunity to review these surveys, nor will the school. They are all sealed, and they are sent to CDC, and that's the end of it. There are no identifying marks or indications of the identity of the participants. So that's my understanding of how it works. And, of course, if you have additional questions, I could have Mr. Kurowski, who seems to be the most knowledgeable person I've dealt with on this matter, because he's been working for the school district for 15 years in this particular area.
Go ahead, Senator Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I know we had good testimony on last Friday. I don't see the need that we need to go back to him. That's just one individual school district that's speaking for what they do at their district. But I want to have your attention to the bill. It's only a couple pages, and so it's not that hard to go through. And if you look at page 1 in the beginning there, you'll find out exactly what the changes are. And then the other parts is on the page 2. And it says exactly what he said as far as making sure written testimony, written notices get to the parents. So the parents may know when the test is going to happen. Can refuse at that time if they do not want their child to take it. And I know when they go to some of the schools, there are a lot of things that they have to fill out and look at. They may get lost, but we say in here, notify the parents to let them know they have the option of withdrawing their child from that particular survey if they do not want them to participate. And not only that, even on the day of the test, the survey, the student may also refuse to take the test, and it's in the statute. And that's where it needs to be, and not in regulation. It needs to be here, so there's a guideline to go by, and I think it's quite clear. It has worked in the past, more so than what we have on the books now. what I have offered.
And through the chair, one follow-up on that. In Section 4, it does indicate that this notice can't be provided later than 2 weeks before the survey is administered. So there is enough time for a parent to respond, inquire, and refuse in writing if they wish to do so.
Chairman, Senator Stevens, yes, please.
Well, thank you. Personally, I would, as a parent, I would not object to my child taking this, but I have had emails from folks in my district and out of my district who do have concerns and probably would have a child not take this poll thing. I understand the importance of it, but what I really want to find out is what the options are for the parent, how the parent hears this. So I understand now that when you register your child, you get some information when you go to the school to register your child. In addition, at some point, a month before the test, the exam, written notice is sent with a child to the home. Just to make sure I understand this, now never do we actually send a letter through the post office, and never do we send an email to the parents. Is that my understanding? And that's, I just need to know, because I think it's fair when people ask that question that we honestly answer it.
Senator Davis?
The only thing I can say about what everybody's doing is that each school district would have to say what they're doing, because every school district do not do it the same way, and that's the point that I'm trying to make. Get it in the statute exactly what they have to do, and then when they write the regs, they write it accordingly. But the way it is now, if you have maybe 15, 20 kids in a school district, you wouldn't have to go through all the things that the school district in Anchorage would have to go through. And they see those people more regularly. They are able to deal with them anytime that they feel like it. But I cannot say school by school what each district will do to administer that test. Some say they have no trouble doing it anyway. They get all the students that they need to do the survey. Others say they're having a hard time getting it. So you have that block in there just in the middle. But I think eventually something is mailed out to the parents. But I don't want to say that every school district does that, because I can't.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, there's nothing in the bill that I can see that indicates the type of notice that must be given, that it has to be written. I know that there was some testimony about maybe electronics being used now with emails with all the parents and so forth. But right now, it's more or less up to the school districts. I understand that information is sent home with children. If they may be doing mailings. I was told they may be doing mailings with this particular survey at this point to give notice to the parents. But again, it may also be tossed aside. I don't know if parents aren't paying attention to it. It's not going to be legal notice with return envelopes and, I mean, with certification and so forth. But they do. My understanding is that they are sending the notice home with a return envelope, stamp addressed envelope, so that this can be returned. So they're giving some pretty formal notice here, whether it is going home with the parent or being mailed to them directly.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. And we had some similar concerns on Friday when we heard this. And I think where I feel comfortable is that the student the day of the test can say I don't want to take this, or I don't want to answer these questions, and so there appears to be several outs if a parent and child does not want to take the survey. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You guys have discussed the area that the biggest objection is whether somebody has to be proactive or not. That's always what I've heard, that the parents have to be proactive to stop the survey from being taken, and this bill has language that causes, at least as Senator Meyer, Chair Meyer indicates, that the choice would be the kid's choice at the time that the survey is handed out to not take it. And I'm sure there will be plenty of discussion at home in anticipation of that happening, but that was always the objection, was that the parent would have to be proactive and say that they didn't want their kid taking it. But obviously, sometimes that information doesn't get home. There's no doubt about that. But if, in fact, at the end of the day, the kid has the opportunity to say, I don't want to take the test, and there's nothing that can be done about it, then I and I don't have a serious problem with it.
Okay, so any other questions from committee members? If not, then let's go online here. And Dr. Hurlbert. Mr. Hurlbert, are you online, sir?
Yes, sir, I am. Thank you, Senator Meyer. I appreciate your opening us up to the testimony again, and I think I'll be brief here. I did want to say that the administration, for the record, I'm Ward Hurlbert. I'm the director of the Public Health Division and the Chief Medical Officer with the Department of Health and Social Services for the state. I did want to state that the administration does have concerns about Senate Bill 8. I appreciate Senator Davis sponsoring the bill, and I absolutely agree that the proposed law would make it easier to obtain the important information that is obtained by the survey. As was discussed on Friday and a little bit this morning, the survey does get at some very sensitive and personal information about young people related to things like diet and activity, but sexual habits, alcohol, other drug use, tobacco use, and so on. With Governor Parnell's very deep commitment to strengthening Alaska's families, the reason for his concern is that it relates a little to the foregoing conversation there. Governor Parnell has felt really ever since he was in the legislature when he supported the bill that laid out the current policy that does strengthen families, strengthen the role of parents more with kids than to have the opt-out provision which is contained in Senate Bill 8. And so that's the reason for his concern for the bill. I'll be glad to take any questions, Senator Meyer.
Okay. Thank you for the testimony. Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hurlbert, you mentioned you know how the survey works.
Through the chair, Senator French, I don't know all the details. The Department of Education administers it, but I'm familiar with the survey. I've read the background material.
Did you listen to the hearing we had last Friday on the subject?
Through the chair, Senator French, yes, sir, I was there during the hearing on Friday.
You understand that it's a survey that goes out and it's filled out anonymously, and the information is compiled with complete anonymity.
Through the chair, Senator French, yes, I do.
And you understand this information is very important so that policymakers can have an idea what's happening to the youth of not only Alaska but to the nation.
Through the chair, Senator French. Yes, that information is important to us as we tailor programs here in Alaska. It's also very important to us as we seek to obtain federal grants, because sometimes the 60% response level is required in order to obtain federal funding.
Thank you. And I guess my last question is, you know, if knowledge is power, and if the current policy results in low compliance rates, How does that strengthen a family to not know what's happening?
Through the chair, Senator French, as Senator Davis described on Friday, and I absolutely agree with her, that this discussion does not relate to the specific questions that are determined by CDC. They're not determined here in Alaska, and if there's concern about some questions, the appropriate avenue is to approach CDC about that. But the questions are indeed very intrusive. They can be read in a way that makes a presumption of certain kinds of activity that parents would be disturbed if their kids are engaging in. And we know that while many kids do engage in activities that we would rather they didn't, there are also many young people who do not. And I think that's the reasoning that I see behind it. To be honest, I can see both sides of the question, but I do respect Governor Parnell's concerns, and I believe that that is consistent with his consistent stance of supporting strong families and the engagement of parents.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator French. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Dr. Herbert, for your testimony. Are there specific areas of the test that you think should not be part of the survey, and or things that you think should be deleted, or things that we could improve? I realize it's not our survey, but potentially if we were to pass along information, what would that be that you would suggest the changes be based on our conversation this morning, and specifically the questions asked by Senator French regarding behavior and some of the concerns that we also have about domestic violence, teen drinking and driving, and teen drunk driving deaths. So are there some specific areas that you would suggest be changed or approached in a different manner?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I don't I think I don't want to mislead the committee in that. The questions cannot be changed. They have to be questions dealing with very sensitive areas to get at the information that we need. And that is not a part of the bill. I've talked with Senator Davis, and my understanding is that's not a part of her intent. I've actually expressed my concerns in that area to CDC. The areas related to sexual habits, that related to drug use, alcohol use, tobacco use, and those kinds of things, we do need to know about. But what I was alluding to is the way the questions may flow. The intent in the survey is to make kids comfortable so that they will ask questions honestly. Sometimes that can come across with a presumption that they may be engaging in behavior that many kids do not engage in.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any other questions?
I do have a question.
Senator Davis.
Thank you. Dr. Holbert, I appreciate you coming to testify. I was wondering why you did not testify on Friday, but I was told that you were here just for question and answer, so I can understand why you did not. I want to also say to you that I appreciate the statement that you made. We did talk in my office. I won't go into details what was said. Pretty much you said it on the record as you were speaking, that you did speak with me. But I want to ask you, as head of public health, this particular survey has to be important to you. And it also allows you the opportunity to receive more federal money. So would you tell me if you can't tell me personally if you support this or not, but you can tell me if this is helpful to change it so that you may get better information, not only you, but all the other organizations that depend on this survey to get the information they need about those questions that's in the survey so that you may receive federal funds to carry out your jobs. Do you feel that this would be helpful in that light?
Through the chair, Senator Davis, yes, I do. This is important information for us. It is important information to our society as we deal with our children. And I have not heard anything from the governor's office that indicates that they do not also think it's important. The difference is that they feel it's that having the opt-in assures the parents' engagement in this, but that in no way lessens the importance of the information or the importance of obtaining that information.
All right, thank you. Could I go further, Mr. Chair? One more comment.
Yeah, or anything else for Dr. Holbert?
Oh no, I don't have another.
Dr.
question.
Dr. Holbert, thank you so much for giving us the governor's position on this bill, and thank you for joining us this morning, Senator Davis.
Thank you, Senator.
I just want I don't know if everybody was here on Friday. I think one person might have been absent. Senator Thomas was not here. But within the testimony that we got on Friday, it was stated that this survey is important and that they thought this change would make it a better way to get the material that we needed, also to save money from the state, because not only are the school districts putting their own money into this survey, so is this Department of Education giving us an amount of money that they're giving to assure that the survey is held. But in the final analysis, what I want to say, there might be some concerns about what's in the test and how the questions could be changed. And there's a way to deal with that, but you do it through CDC, and it has nothing to do with the bill that's before you. And I'd like for you to take that in consideration when it comes time to decide if you want to move this out of this committee or not. Because we can't do anything about the questions that's there. It has to be done at that level. And if you want to address that, of which I did tell Dr. Holberg that also, and he said he has written letters to CDC, I told him he could strengthen it by having more people to sign on to the letter maybe. And they do review that test and change it from time to time. And they might take in consideration what they said. But the issue about strengthening families and giving them the more authority to have their children opt out of this program is right here in this bill on how they can do it. And you know, as a retired social worker, I've had a lot of families come before me. I am a family person. I am a mother, a grandmother. I have worked with children all my life. I want to do everything I can do to protect them. And I definitely wouldn't introduce a bill that's going to harm families. And you have to be careful to the point that when people spoke on Friday, they said most of the people do not return them because they are too busy to return them, not because they object to the survey itself. And when you have people trying to shelter their children, sometimes they are doing it in a negative way to keep information from coming out that might tell something that's going on in that family. So you can't just say because you given them the authority to say you don't have to take the test that you're protecting families. You're not. And that's all I have to say. I would like you to take that in consideration when you review where you want to move this bill out or not.
Okay, thank you, Senator Davis. And I think I voiced my concerns Friday that, you know, I thought some of the questions were unnecessary, like, for example, how many times have you eaten carrots in the last week? And but other questions like dealing with smoking and drinking, and I know I personally have had a lot of bills dealing with trying to prevent kids from drinking and smoking underage, and there's really no way as lawmakers to know if our bills are effective without getting this type of feedback. And I think the fact that there are several ways out of this survey, if people do find it offensive, I'm comfortable with moving the bill. Is there any other comments from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Bill 8 version / A be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations, and I believe there is a zero fiscal note.
Correct. Okay. Any objections? Seeing and hearing none, bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease as we switch out the presenters. Okay, we're back on record. Just to let everyone know, we will not take up Senate Bill 6 today. We'll hold off and take that up at our next meeting. So let's go right forward here to our guests that have joined us. I do appreciate the three chancellors from the University of Alaska system joining us today. We have the chancellor from UIS, UAF, and UAA. Of course, that's Chancellor Case, Chancellor Rogers, and Chancellor Pugh. And I think how we'd like to start this is just, first of all, Chancellor Case, you're the new guy on the block, and want to give you an opportunity to say a few words and introduce yourself to the Education Committee, Senate Education Committee. And then the other chancellors, if you would like to make any comments, you're more than welcome to, and then we'll open it up for questions. So with that,
well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to start by thanking you and the members of the committee for your engagement and support of moving education ahead in Alaska. I know many of you from my prior university experience and most recently from Alaska Aerospace experience, and I would tell you that through all my military career years ago now and my experience with the university, I've become to believe how critically important doing education well is as a pathway for individual students, but also for the future of the state, and perhaps now more so than ever. So I am absolutely delighted to be incoming chancellor of UAA. Chancellor Ulmer and I are in a transition period. As you can imagine, there is much for me to learn because of the tremendous progress over the last 3 years. But I can tell you I'm delighted to be working with my new colleagues, Chancellor Pugh and Chancellor Rogers, as we work together to move this state ahead. And your support and engagement in that process is much appreciated. So with that, Chancellor Pugh.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to also thank the committee for past support. It's been a really important thing to have the support of the legislature over the last decade, really, as we've grown the university. And I'd like to just make a couple comments about the state of the university, because we're all concerned about that. And as we look at it, there's many ways to look at it. And as you know, there's been a lot said about our graduation rates. But one of the things that I do want to say is that some of the programs that we've started, some of the things that we've done have made a difference. We've had a steady increase of Alaskan high school students coming into, you know, the University of Alaska, and an increase in high school students going on to post-secondary education in the state. We were one of the lowest, we were either 49th or 50th, fighting with Hawaii for last on students going to post-secondary education. We have improved that, and we continue to improve getting those students in. We also have an improving freshman retention rate. We are now at or above the national average in our retention of freshmen in the University of Alaska system. And the third thing is we have good graduation rates in certain programs. With former President Hamilton, we worked with the legislature on specific areas called high-need jobs that the Labor Department determines. And in those high-need jobs areas, such as nursing and engineering, accounting, business management, we have put a lot of resources into those areas, and we do much better in those areas where we've increased the resources, and we are getting good graduation rates, and the industry are very happy with our graduates. We also have expanded workforce training in that area, and I'll just give you some examples from Southeast. We have a very strong marine operations training program in Ketchikan, working with the Marine Highway System as well as all the providers of marine operations throughout Southeast, and we train hundreds of people each year in marine safety and other training programs that are required by the Coast Guard. That program is not a credited program. That's workforce training, and it comes in a non-credited way. We do the same thing in mine safety training. Here in Juneau, we have a underground mine safety training center. We've trained 1,000 people through that center in mine safety training. We also have trained the underground miners themselves. And finally, in health information and records management, we have people all over the state responding to the national requirements and in terms of the electronic record keeping and so on. And those are just three examples in workforce where you don't have credits, but you have training, and people are going through the training, they're upgrading, they're getting the jobs. Final thing, we've made a lot of improvements on e-learning, or what used to be called distance ed. And of course, hard to call it distance ed when a lot of the people who are taking those courses are students in the dorms, you know, because they want the convenience also of taking electronic learning. So, but we had last year 40% of our students took at least one electronic learning course. So, and we continue to make improvements. We now have a unified system that's coming online for fall, where everybody can go in and look at that and choose their menu. So finally, then I would say, we know we've got a problem with six-year graduation rates. We're not, you know, obviously we track the same data you track. It is a problem in Alaska. We're working on it, but we also will need everybody to work on it, because some of it is personal, some of it is financial aid, and some of it is us in making the better use of our resources to make sure that we try to get students through and 4 to 6 years, depending on what programs they're in. And I'll stop there. But I want to thank you again for your help.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you for the record, Brian Rogers, Chancellor of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And I'd like to just start by thanking you for actions during the last year and this year, two that are really significant. One, the largest capital investment in higher education in the state's history in the bond issue that you sent to the voters last year and the voters approved overwhelmingly. That will make a huge difference at campuses throughout the state in terms of improving the facilities available for instruction, the facilities for research, and the facilities for student life. It is really going to be transformative to the system. Second, one of the challenges that we've had in achieving the six-year graduation rate is the number of students who run out of money and have to work part-time and go to school part-time. They keep going, and our 10-year graduation rate and our 12-year continues to improve, but your approval of merit and need-based scholarship aid will make a significant difference in our graduation rates. As we look to what can we do that changes that, financial aid is one, better advising is a second, and all three institutions are working on that, and the third is ensuring that the course sequences work, that we don't end up skipping a year. If we can address those three issues, and with your help, the first one, we're making a difference. And the Fisher report that came out earlier this year, this academic year, really stressed the issue of time to graduation. I think from that report, that's job one for us, is improving that. We sit before you as three institutions, but one system. And the three institutions collaborate, we cooperate, and from time to time, we compete. But I think when we look at where we're collaborating and cooperating, it's pretty significant, whether it's teacher education, working three institutions together, engineering, all three institutions, although UAS does not offer an engineering degree, they're preparing students to come to UAA and to UAF. In health education, with a lead institution of UAA, but providing services throughout the state, with research, UAF is the lead, but with research going on throughout the state. We really try to act as one system, even though we're three accredited institutions. We wanted to keep our introduction brief so that we could answer the questions that are on your mind. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and take whatever questions you and the members of the committee may have.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for your opening remarks. Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. A pleasure to have you with us, and thank you for your years of service to the institution, and we're very proud of the university and pleased with pleased to have General Case back and in that position, and all three of you here. As we've studied the problems that the legislature sees with education, higher education, it really came down to three things: remedial education, advising and counseling, and the third thing would be scholarships. Scholarships are our issue, and we're trying to solve that. But the big issue with remedial education is, it seems to me, we have an open university, anyone can come, and obviously we're having problems with our K-12. We're graduating students that are not prepared to compete on the college level, and so it falls to you. to prepare them to compete. And that's such an important issue. I mean, I think we need some, we've come to the point we really need some innovative thinking on how do we get these young people from prepared to really compete on the college level. And we've talked about maybe an academy through high schools. That's going to be hard for the school districts to do. I know with the University of Alaska or University of California system, if you were to take a class at the university, you pay X dollars. If you go to the community college, you pay half of that. We don't have that because we are a consolidated system. What can we do? Are there ways that we can help students, the way we can move people forward and help those students to actually compete? And what I'm thinking is, you know, if the university could say, okay, if you take a remedial education class and say English, and it doesn't count to graduation, but you're going to pay a lot of money to get it, next class you take will charge you half price for that. I mean, are there innovative things that we can do to really help students move forward in their college careers?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stevens, there are a number of things we can do. The first one, obviously, is starting with working with the K-12 system. As you know, last few years, we've talked about working with the K-12 system, and we do that in a lot of ways. One way is having summer programs that help in remediation and help students who are motivated and parents are motivated bring students in who really can upgrade and make a sort of look at those areas where they're deficient and come through. We actually provide testing, our placement testing, to students in their sophomore year in high school, and we hope that parents and students will look at that and recognize that, you know, they're a long way from being ready to go to college. You know, we have a false system here where we have a test that we give our students in K-12, and students think that somehow prepares them for something that it doesn't prepare them for. That test does not tell you anything about whether you're ready for college. It tells you that you met some minimum standards. And that is something that we've got to get out. And I think the scholarship program that you have been working on will make a difference in that, because some of it is expectations, that we have lowered our expectations in Alaska and what it means, you know, to graduate. And many of you have said that and are working on. So I think at least that piece, we're starting to all work on you know, expanding those expectations, making clear to students that it's not enough to have 2 years of math in high school. You can't, for anything, whether you want to be an electrician, be a plumber, 2 years of math isn't going to do it. So I think that's one that I think we can't, is very important, and we're all involved in that policy issue in terms of it. In terms of remediation, we've done a lot of things, but we are talking now about things going back to things we've tried. It's sort of like Back to the Future. And we are going at UAS next year introduce what we had as a bridge program before, where when you come in and if you need to remediate in both math and English, you're going to have to go into one semester program where you cannot apply for a program in university. You're going to have to just be in this remediation program. And it will actually be for math, English. We will also have some computing, and we will have a course called Humanities 101, which we already teach, which will be mandatory for those individuals for study skills and, you know, learning how to really be a college student. So we're going to go back. We did that years ago. We probably should have never abandoned it, but, you know, some of it, we got caught up in financial aid stuff where the Fed said you had to be full-time, you had to be in a program, and what we're saying is, that's not a good way of doing it. We're telling students that you can do something you can't do. We first need to do the remediation back. So I think all of us have programs like that, and so that's one way of getting at this remediation, is on that first semester, your job when you come in, our job is going to be to tell the student, you are not ready for college, and this is what you have to do in order to get there if you really want to be in college. And what we've been doing is sort of piecemealing it. They take one remediation course, take other courses. They get, you know, C's, D's in them. Some of them flunk them. That's not a good idea, and it's a waste of state money, a waste of federal money. So we're trying to go back and do it. The other thing is mandatory advising. Mandatory advising, and I know you have been talking about this, critical to get that in place. We're moving to it next fall. We already had it for students who, in their first semester, we're below 2.0, but we're going to go to all freshman student mandatory advising and continue with, if you're below a 2.0, you continued in that mandatory advising thing. So those are the things we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add just a little bit to that, I think once we're to remediation, we're later than we should be. And so what we've been trying to do is to attack it at the front end with quite a wide variety of summer enrichment programs that are designed for high school and, in some cases, junior high school. The Rural Alaska Honors Institute, now 29 years old, does a fantastic job in taking sophomores, juniors, and seniors from rural Alaska, giving them the college experience and helping to spark that interest that they realize they can do the work, and they realize what it's going to take to be in college. The Alaska Summer Research Academy, the Visual Arts Academy, the Summer Fine Arts, sort of regardless of field, trying to find ways to spark the interest at the ninth grade, 10th grade level so that they understand what it's like for college. I want to echo John's point, though, is we said high school graduation qualifying exam, you have to get this far. We haven't said to be ready for college, you have to be here. And I think the two-year math is probably the biggest problem. We see the students, the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District requires 3 years of math to graduate, and we have better results from those students who take more math and science in school. What you're doing with the Performance Scholarship helps create an incentive, a financial incentive, for students to work a little bit harder, to stress themselves. And we know from successful programs like UAA, a UAF ANSET program, that pushing kids a little bit, they respond well to it, and then we don't have to spend as much time remediating. Finally, we too have, about 3 years ago, for admission to a baccalaureate program at UAF, the student needs to be prepared. So if they're underprepared based on grade point average or based on test scores, they're admitted to school and can take courses, but they're not yet in a baccalaureate program until they've shown that they're successful. That one of the reasons we have a poor six-year graduation rate is too many kids have to spend the first year and sometimes longer getting prepared.
Okay, very good. Other questions? Senator Thomas.
Along that line of the thank you all for your brief presentations anyhow, and along that line of counseling and advising, as we looked at the scholarship program, we found that this is an entire system beginning with kindergarten or even pre-K, you know. So we had probably 10 things on a list that we think should be emphasized, you know, along the road. And, of course, counseling was a big one, and recognition of issues and problems. So what you're considering in college, we think much of that should be obviously considered in high school and even earlier on. Obviously, the teacher preparedness or teacher education program would be important to make sure that as the kids come along, issues are recognized and remediated early on. We're talking about second, third, fourth grade, because the experts tell you that by third grade, you probably have a very good indication of where a kid is headed without remediation or some attempt to get the optimal performance out of them. So with that in mind, what impact do you think that has on the teacher preparedness? Are you going back and looking at that and saying, innovation needs to be put in place here. We need to change things along the road with the program to make sure that when the student or when the teacher comes out of school, they are more prepared for today's world than maybe we needed to be prepared 30 years ago or something like that.
Well, let me again, through the chair. Having been a former dean of education as well as worked with the committee that's been looking at this for SB 241. You know, this is there's a mixture here in terms of how we responded to this. But first place, we, for example, in reading, one of the critical issues for kids is learning to read. And one of the things that came with No Child Left Behind was real emphasis on reading. And we have a specialized reading program at UAS, and we also work with both the other campuses on this in terms of bringing those the latest technologies, in a sense, the latest theories on reading to the new students, the new teachers, as well as to have teachers come back. And one of the things we have at UAS in the summer is an academy for teachers who are already out in school districts. It's been very popular, and teachers come back. And we use the school district for clinical practice for those teachers. And the school district sends us those students in elementary and middle school grades that are behind in their reading, And we have those students working with them there. So they're getting that practice with faculty working with them and so on so they can learn the techniques to do it. We also, throughout the system, have tried to do that with math education. I would say that we're not as good in the math education area as we are in the reading literacy area, where I think we have made a lot of progress with our faculty and with our students and in those programs. But we are working on the math area as well across the whole system to improve our math education, because that's going to be critical for the younger students to get the appropriate math education, and for our teachers coming out to have that. And again, some of that has to do with us getting a lot of students going out of high school not prepared in math, complicate that even more. And so we're trying to again working on that whole math area as an educational system all the way from pre-K through college. We've got to work on strengthening the math because it's critical.
And just if I may, we have a lot of comments, particularly from rural legislators regarding the scholarship that in their schools they're not even offered the courses that would allow them to qualify for the scholarship. So much less some of the grade points and things. So do you have feedback? Do you take what you guys see at your level and try and feed that back into the system to the Department of Education, saying we see a real need in these particular areas and we can help, but we see your system needing to change to accommodate that? Do you that kind of thing?
Through the chair, I think there's good awareness at the department of that challenge. I think what we're doing and where we can make a difference is in looking at ways to extend science and math education via distance to those rural schools. And we've got some faculty who are trying to work on distance courses or modules in physics and other areas to try to reach students who otherwise don't have access to a physics course in high school, et cetera. Really nascent attempts, but I think trying to figure out ways that we can help fill that gap. We're not going to be able to get physics teachers or into every rural high school. That's just not feasible. So we have to come up with an alternative.
Thank you.
Through the chair, if I may, Senator Thomas, I agree entirely with my colleagues here on the point I think that is being made here, that there are two critical pillars. One is the advising and counseling, because the students have to know what's expected, where an honest appraisal of where their shortfalls are if they're to get what they need in order to move to the next level successfully. And then the other part of that is a good balance, I believe, in mix of needs-based and performance-based scholarships, because one without the other only serves a portion of the population. And so to have a combination of both available to students, and I take that partially from my experience as a dean, watching Student Information Office expansion and work and working with scholarships, but also back to my own growing up in a small town in Eastern Oregon, took every math and science course offered, and when I arrived at the Air Force Academy, I was in trouble because I was not properly prepared. Now, others of my cadet classmates had a better assessment counseling structure in place, and they competed and went to a year of prep school for the Air Force Academy before they became cadets. They were much better positioned in that first year than I was. I made it, but it was a struggle. So I think we're on the right track to have a balance of needs-based and performance-based scholarships buttressed by a very high focus on counseling and advising.
Very good thing.
Okay. Just one question I have. First of all, I want to thank all three of you for being very supportive of helping fill our needs here in the state of Alaska. I know we've had a shortage of teachers, nurses, and some other very important job classifications, and we've worked on that and have helped fulfill that need. One concern I have is that, there's been some talk about a law school or a medical school, but it seems like we have some schools or colleges in place already that probably aren't fully expanded. And so my personal feeling is, before we start anew, let's you know, expand and fulfill what we have. And one area of concern is the engineering college. It's my understanding petroleum and mechanical engineering is offered at UAF. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. UAF offers petroleum, mining, geological, electrical, computer, civil, and UAA offers civil and then the Bachelor of Science in Engineering with specialties in concentrations in mechanical, electrical, et cetera.
Okay.
And in both cases, we embarked on a six-year plan to double the number of engineering graduates. We should reach that by 2014. We are facility constrained at both institutions right now. Thanks to your efforts last year, we do have funds for planning the next increment of engineering facilities. We've doubled the number of students in most of the programs, petroleum. We've tripled the number of students. So we're well on track, and we know we'll reach that goal of doubling the number of graduates. But if you look at the facilities at both UAA and UAF, you'll wonder how the faculty can manage to do it in the space we have.
Right. And I am aware of that. And I know Senator Ellis has made it a priority to expand the engineering colleges at both campuses, UAA and UAF. But it does concern me still that we are bringing up too many petroleum engineers from outside. So however we can help in that area. And again, we were talking about math earlier. Certainly you need a lot of math to get into the engineering field. I don't think there was a question there, just a comment. Any other questions from committee members? Again, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're going to be here throughout the day talking at various forums, and so we should have opportunities to ask you more questions as the day goes on.
Again, thank you for your
thank
support.
Thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Your support.
Thank you for joining us. Okay, with that, I do have a kind of a housekeeping question. Next Monday, we need to know who's going to be here for our 8 o'clock meeting next Monday. I will be here. I think Senator Davis, you said you're here.
I'm not going out of time. I'm planning to be here Monday. Yes.
Okay.
And get the plane, get here.
Yeah. And I think Senator Thomas, you said you'd be back from D.C.
I will.
Okay. All right. So we will have a quorum. I think the other two here is going to be a little bit later, Monday sometime.
A little bit later.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Then we'll have a quorum. So why don't we go ahead and meet next Monday at 8 o'clock, and we'll take up Senate Bill 6, and let's see, what else do we have here? We'll get started on the BSA, Senate Bill 84 and Senate Bill 73. Probably won't get too far on that. I'm sorry? I think they're both...
Same bill on her side that we initiate.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll introduce both of them, and you can withdraw yours if you like. But we'll start with Senate Bill 6 and see how far we get on that before we take up the BSA bills. So we'll be here next Monday. That's March 7th at 8 o'clock. And with that, nothing else. We're adjourned.